Acts chapter 14, verse 23, tells of some of the work that Paul the Apostle and his preaching companion Barnabas did together in their first preaching journey, and how after they had traveled through several cities, they passed back through those cities in order to visit with the brethren that had been left behind there, and churches that had been established. And verse 23 tells us that they appointed elders in every church. This is a description of the way in which apostles ordered churches, how they brought to a state of approvedness congregations. And if you want to find out what a church should look like and how a church should function, and then what you need to do is to look into the New Testament and find out what those local congregations did and how they did it. And that's the way to order a church today. Now, I'm not telling you that that's the way all churches are ordered, because that would certainly be far from the truth. People have devised different ways in which they would order churches. And actually, among early Christians, those development of different ways began to occur not long after the establishment of the church. And you get into the second century, and you find history reveals to us that among believers there came to be differing ways of organizing the church, and you see some departures from the way that churches were organized. You see a departure along the same period of time from the way that churches worshiped, and you see a departure from the kind of work that churches did. Those are basically three areas of how churches are ordered in their organization, in their worship, and in their work. And early on, people departed from this ordering that the apostles had brought to the early churches. It was in the experience of many people here tonight that among Christians, among brethren in this country, similar kinds of departures in organization, in worship, and in the work of a congregation, similar kind of departures occurred once again shortly after the Second World War. And brethren became divided over these things. And as I say, many folks here went through that. If you grew up like I did, you know, in the 60s, you heard preachers a lot talking about the autonomy and the independence of a local congregation. And those phrases just came together. They talk about the independence and the autonomy of the church. So much so that a lot of folks began to think that, well, independence and autonomy, those are just, they're synonymous. They mean the same thing. But they don't. They mean quite different things. But they are descriptive of what the New Testament, though they really don't, those words don't appear in the New Testament, they are descriptive of what the New Testament describes those apostolically ordered churches as being. They were independent churches, and they were autonomous churches. And so if we're going to understand and indeed replicate in our efforts the kind of churches that we read about in the New Testament, then we're going to need to understand what it means to be autonomous, what it means to be independent. Now, I'm reasonably confident that we have new Christians among us who probably have never heard anything about a church being autonomous or independent. And so they need to hear about that. And it may very well be that there are some older in the faith among us who never really caught on to what those things mean. And so they need to hear about it. And it may be that some heard these things in the past, as I was talking about, but we just need to be reminded from time to time of some vital things about the nature of the Lord's church. So I just want to talk to you about these two things tonight, about how a New Testament church is autonomous and how it is independent. And let's talk about its independency first. And I know I don't have to spend much time, you know, defining what independence is this audience. Anything that is said to be independent is not dependent. Our nation broke away from Great Britain and declared its independence, that we were no longer going to be dependent upon that nation, but we were going to operate separate from it, free of attachments to it. And so our independence was declared. And that's what we find really being described about these apostolically ordered churches of the New Testament age, that they existed as independent congregations. That is, they had no organic tie to any other congregation. The first church that we read about being established is, of course, the church that was in Jerusalem. But then in Acts chapter 11, we read about some who had been in that Jerusalem church leaving Jerusalem and going out into various areas. And as they went, because they were under persecution, as they went preaching the word. And we get a little glimpse into what happened in the course of events when we come to Acts, the 11th chapter, and we have described these people who had been driven away from Jerusalem, some of them coming to the city of Antioch. And there's just a wonderful little lesson that's contained there about how to start a church. You want to know how to start a church? Read Acts chapter 11, about verse 19 and following. And what you see that those people did was, They just preached the word. They just taught the truth. And that's the way you start. That's the way you start a church, is you just teach the truth. And so that word was accepted. It was believed by people of Antioch, and a church began. Now, the text tells us that the brethren back in Jerusalem heard about this. And they sent people there, Paul and Barnabas, They sent people there in order to encourage the Christians in that new church. But there is no indication, no description, no reference whatsoever to the Jerusalem church exerting its will over that new church in Antioch. There's no description of any kind of organizational tie between them. Now, I mean, you know, you can know that someone exists. You can know that another church exists as Jerusalem came to know about Antioch without exerting some kind of governing control over that group. As I say, the story about Antioch and the beginning of Antioch is really just a glimpse into what was happening as these brethren were leaving from Jerusalem and going in all kinds of different ways, in all kinds of different directions. We're told about Philip's going to Samaria to preach and the acceptance of the gospel there. Samaria would have been much closer in geographical location to Jerusalem. But once again, there's no indication in scriptures of the Jerusalem church saying, okay, well, now we're going to take over down here in Samaria, and we're going to guide and direct. Now, that is exactly what happens in the second century, in that early time, when early Christians began to depart from the patterns of apostolic directions about the organization and the work of a congregation. That's exactly what happened. They began to develop some connections between congregations that the apostles had not approved. The apostles had not taught. And so you have the development of the idea of a district and of churches being in that district, that geographical area, and the churches that fell within that district would come under the rule of some particular group. It might be the Jerusalem church, the mother church in the eyes of some. You have the development then of leaders in relationships that were foreign to the New Testament. You have particular district, and you have these different congregations, and you have elders over each of the congregations. Well, they would send one elder from each congregation, and among all of those churches in that particular district, and all of these elders then would come together, and they would oversee the district. Now, that may make perfect sense to you. It made perfect sense to people of that age. It has made perfect sense to a lot of people throughout history. But it's just absent from the way that the apostles ordered the churches of the first century. The way that they ordered those churches was for them to exist independently. There's a perfect, it seems to me, opportunity for there to be something of that district kind of organization to be set up and described in the scriptures when you're reading Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3. And we're reading there about churches 7 of them that existed in a geographical area that we generally identify as Asia Minor. If you ever get a map out, you can look at these 7 churches, and they form a pretty small circle. So that they're pretty close to one another. In Revelation 2 and 3, I'm sure many of you will recall that have letters written to these churches. Letters written from the Lord. And in which he speaks about each one of these congregations. And you know, the amazing thing as you read through these 7 letters is there's no reference to any tie, any organizational, governmental kind of tie between these congregations. They're dealt with by the Lord in a completely independent fashion. He has some very good things to say to some. He has some corrective things to say to most. And to 2 of them, to the church in Sardis and the church in Laodicea, he has nothing but condemnation. You know what's interesting? Is that those other 5 churches are never told, you know, those folks in Sardis and those folks in Laodicea, they're just missing, they're missing the boat badly. And so you just need to take care about them. And there's no instructions about taking any kind of corrective action to these 5 churches directed towards Sardis or Laodicea. There's nothing said about, okay, the district office needs to become involved in this and get these 2 places straightened out. They are dealt with by the Lord absolutely, independently of all the other congregations. And when the Lord threatens them with, as he puts it, the removal of their candlestick, there were 7 candlesticks described in a vision in those chapters. And when the Lord threatens them with correction, with the fact that they were going to lose their identification as his people, and he would remove their candlestick. Again, it was a threat that was made directly to them, dealing with them as an independent congregation. You'll be held responsible for your deeds. You'll be treated accordingly. The point I want you to see is that when you read through the New Testament and you read about these early churches, is that what we need to appreciate about them is their independence. When you look in 1 Peter chapter 5, and we read there about some instructions that the Apostle Peter gives, he identifies himself as an elder and addresses himself to others who are elders, and he urges them to behave in a certain way in that relationship that they have. I exhort, verse 1, the elders among you, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God. There's this charge to them. You shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. Verse 2, he says, you shepherd the flock of God. Which one? He says, you shepherd the flock of God among you. The authority that elders have goes no farther than the congregation that they are a part of. Because that congregation is independent. It is free of attachments, free of organizational ties to other congregations. Now, in the course of time, both ancient times and then more recently among brethren, in the course of time, some elderships became unwilling to limit themselves in this fashion. And they sought to oversee and to exert influences and guidance in churches, not only that they were a part of, but other churches as well. And in doing so, they departed from the pattern of the New Testament. And the way that New Testament churches were ordered was no longer the standard by which they were guided. So, we need to appreciate the fact that if this congregation is going to be a congregation patterned after the New Testament, then it needs to remain independent. But it also needs to be autonomous. Now, what does that mean, to be autonomous? It's actually a word that is created by the combination of two Greek words, autos, which means self, and nomos, which means law, self-law. And the point is that a New Testament congregation is a self-lawed organization. It is a self-ruled organization. It is independent of ties to other groups, and as such then, it exerts a governance over itself. And I think we find some indications of that in the Scriptures. Acts chapter 6, we see the occurrence when there was a problem that arose in the Jerusalem church, in that some of the Hellenistic or Greek Jews who were widows were being neglected in the daily care that was being administered to widows in that church. And so some raised objection about this. And in verse 2, we're told that the 12, that is the apostles, summoned the congregation of the disciples and said, "It's not desirable for us to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables. Select from among you, brethren, 7 men of good reputation, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we may put in charge of this task." We see the self-rule of this congregation at work. The apostles were certainly men who had authority. Jesus had told them in Matthew the 19th chapter, "You're going to sit on 12 thrones ruling the 12 tribes of Israel." But he also instructed them in the course of his earthly ministry with them about how they were to limit or to govern their authority. He says, "You won't be like the rulers among the Gentiles. You won't be that authoritarian kind of leader. That's not going to be permissible to you." So we see that there were certainly men present who had authority in that church, but they respected the self-rule of the congregation, and they put this into the hands of the disciples to make this choice. We see other instances in the New Testament of when similar sorts of things were done. Mike made a reference in his lessons to 1 Corinthians chapter 16, where Paul is writing, giving instructions about the collection for the saints that were in need. He says, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, let each one of you put aside and save as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomever you may approve, I shall send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. And if it is fitting for me to go also, they will go with me. And we're familiar, Mike made some good points regarding the the giving on the first day of the week and how this was done. But I want you to notice that Paul says when he arrives and these funds have been gathered up and made ready to be sent on to Jerusalem, he says when I arrive, those that you approve will carry these funds. Well, why was that? Well, it's because this is an autonomous church. It is a self-ruling church. And it rules and it decides about its contribution as well. You want to know why? Paul says the people that you pick will carry these funds. It's because it's their money. It's that church's money. And they would decide who would carry it to the brethren that were in need. And in fact, Paul goes on and he says, and if it's fitting for me to go also, they'll go with me. Paul wasn't going to travel with this group of messengers. He wasn't going to travel with them unless this congregation said, it'll be okay for you to do that. If you turn back over to Acts, the 11th chapter, we see another demonstration of this kind of self-rule, a self-decision-making power that resided within this congregation. Verse 27 says that at this time some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them named Agabus stood up and began to indicate by the Spirit that there would certainly be a great famine all over the world. And this took place in the reign of Claudius. And in the proportion that any of the disciples had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. And this they did, sending it in charge of Barnabas and Saul to the elders. Now notice, what was the basis upon which this collection was made? Well, it was made upon the basis of this church deciding what they would do. And they decided that in the proportion that any of the disciples had means, that they determined to send a contribution for the relief of those brethren in Judea. But it was they who decided. And it was they who then sent those funds in the care of Barnabas and Saul or Paul. They selected who would carry these funds. They selected where these funds were going to be carried to the place that they were, that it was needed in Judea. They decided the use that these funds were going to be put to. It was going to be put to the relief of those brethren in that area. Why? Well, it's because it's their money. That's why. It's that church's money. And they, as an autonomous organization, had the right to make such decisions. And so These funds were put into the charge of Barnabas and Saul, who carried it to the elders. Well, why carry it to the elders? Well, it would probably be pretty hard to find a better group who could expedite the distribution of these funds. It wasn't put in the elders' charge for them to now decide what was going to be done with the funds. That's already been decided, what's going to be done with the funds. But it was entrusted to them because they're trustworthy men who would distribute these funds in a way that they were intended. We could look at other examples, I think, but I hope this suffices to demonstrate the nature of the apostolically ordered New Testament churches as being organizations that existed independently and that exercised self-determination, exercised self-rule over themselves. And if we want to be a New Testament church, then we're going to have to be willing to limit ourselves to those kinds of qualities, regardless of the fact that some people might say, well, you know, if we joined with the church in Brea and we got a church over in Saddleback to join, you know, we being joined together and organized together like that, we could accomplish so much. Well, the problem with that is they didn't do that in the New Testament. And it doesn't matter how much we think it might be more efficient and that it might work better and that it might produce things that would be an improvement. It doesn't change the fact that that's not the way New Testament churches were ordered. And we need to be willing to be satisfied with the way they were ordered. If you're not a member of the Lord's church, you need to be part of that group. And once again, the New Testament is the source of information to tell you how you can become a part of that. There are a lot of different churches that would tell you a lot of different things about how to become a part of their organization. But the only place you're going to find that will tell you how to become a part of the Lord's church is the Lord's Word. And therein we find that people in that first century who formed those congregations that we've been talking about were people who came to believe the message that was taught in the gospel, that Jesus is the Son of God. And in that belief, they turned away from their sins and they sought to follow Him. They confessed Him as the Son of God. And the New Testament tells us that they were baptized. And in doing so, they washed the guilt of their sins away. If you want to become a Christian, that's the way you have to become one. Because that's the only way that the New Testament describes people becoming Christians. So if your desire tonight is to simply become a Christian, then our desire is to help you. If you would let us know of your desire, we'd be thrilled to help you give your obedience tonight while we stand and sing. Just as